Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Dr. Lee Warren is a neurosurgeon. He's an inventor. He's also an author. And today we're going to talk with him about his book, No Place to Hide, A Brain Surgeon's Long Journey Home from the Iraq War. Dr. Warren, welcome to LifeQuest.
Thank you.
Your book is fascinating to me. I'm enjoying reading it. I'm over halfway through, starting it last night, frankly. And what a journey, one that you didn't expect, and the results of your time there were unexpected. What prompted you to write this book at this time?
The biggest reason that I wrote the book was that for several years after I got home from the war, I struggled with what I ultimately realized was post-traumatic stress disorder. In my quest to try to unlock some of those things that I was carrying inside me, my wife suggested that I start journaling and writing, and ultimately that led to writing the book.
This result of your being over there was sort of unexpected to you.
Yes, sir.
Did you have any expectations before you went to Iraq? And were any of them right?
Well, that's a great question. I, of course, expected to be involved in taking care of injured people, and I expected to be exposed to some difficult things. But I think most of us were fairly naive as to the effects of dealing with the types of carnage that we faced, and the almost daily mortar attacks, and the fact that we were actually in danger. I think the biggest thing that I didn't appreciate was I had this idea that since I wasn't going to be in combat or carrying a weapon, that I would be, you know, perfectly safe over there.
Didn't work out that way.
Didn't really work out that way, and also I don't think any of us, including the structure, the command structure, understood that the providers, the healthcare providers, actually have a much higher incidence of post-traumatic stress issues than the combatants do, because we see the death and dying every single day, nonstop, as opposed to, you know, intermittently. So for me, that was something I wasn't expecting, and didn't really even understand while it was happening to me.
Tell the audience about what was happening in your personal life. You were a very successful surgeon in the States. You realized that maybe things weren't going so well family-wise. You had children, you had a wife, and now you're going over into a war zone. Turmoil in your mind about all of that.
Yes, sir. The time at which I was deployed was really a difficult time for me because, as you said, I was going through really the end of a marriage. I was in a really difficult place in my life. I was kind of a control freak, person who thought I could sort of manage my life on my own, and really had kind of hit the wall with my professional need for being in control at the same time as my personal life was crumbling, and those two things weren't working for me, and my faith was at an all-time low, and then my brother had a stroke and nearly died right before I had left for the war. So when I took off for Iraq, my life in the States was in a really bad place. And so it was a really difficult time for me personally. When I arrived at the war, I had already felt like I had been in a war for quite some time.
It seems as if at some point through this whole experience, you realized that all of the people that you were interacting with, whether it were enemy combatants or your fellow soldiers or your fellow medical colleagues, they all had personal issues in lives, right?
That's right. That's right. One of the first times I realized that was during one of the first church services I went to there, and we had a mortar attack during the service, and basically the pastor just encouraged us to keep on worshiping and praying as it went along, and while I was watching that experience unfold, not only for myself but for the people around me, I saw the way that people were reacting to the stress we were under, and it really just sort of dawned on me that we were all in it together, and that everyone had left a life behind, and everyone had left their own problems and situations behind, and we were all there sort of dealing with them together.
And you were moving past the kind of labeling of these are patients, or these are the enemy, or these are the good guys, to real human beings.
That's right. In fact, we had an experience that really stayed with me, and I wrote about it in the book, of learning that you usually don't know, almost never do you know, the real story of someone else. And that happened early on while I was there, that the patient that we were told was the terrorist who had set off this particular bomb that brought all of these people to the emergency room that day that we were taking care of. And we had to take care of the man that we believed to be the cause of all that carnage. And then for several days after we cared for him, all of us were a little leery around him, and people were doing their jobs but maybe not being super kind to him. And, and there was obviously a language barrier, but you could just see the way people interacted with him. There was some anger and hostility, as if he were the cause of us all being there, almost.
Right.
And then some soldiers came in with the real story, that the gentleman we thought was the terrorist was actually an innocent bystander, and the real terrorist had been apprehended, and they'd gotten the whole story. And then all of a sudden, everyone was different around this gentleman that we had thought was the terrorist. And boy, that really stuck with me as a way that to learn that you really don't know someone's story.
Mm-hmm.
And if you start thinking that you do know someone's story, you're frequently going to be surprised when you find the truth. And so I resolved at that point, I think all of us did, that everybody was a patient who needed our care. And regardless of what we thought we might know about them, we were going to care for them with the same standard and the same level of empathy. And that really changed not just my care delivery in the war, but I think the way I treat people in my whole life.
I was just going to say that's true in civilian life too, isn't it? That we don't know people, and what we see isn't always what is. What I have enjoyed about the book is you've got a really great balance between the description of the medical procedures and what you were doing to help these people, and the real sense of being there. You describe the dust and the dirt and the explosions and all this sort of thing. Sometimes this must have been tremendously overwhelming to you.
Yes, sir. One of the things I tried to do is, because again, when I started writing, it was to try to unpack these memories for myself. So one of the things I tried very carefully to do was to try to place myself back there and feel what I was feeling, smell what I was smelling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's important, if we're going to try to explain our story to someone, that we really try to help them to feel the emotion of it as well. And that's what I tried.
You said a little bit earlier that not only was your personal life somewhat in shambles as you deployed, but your personal faith wasn't what it should have been. Do I pick up a suggestion that the things that you were going through in a war zone actually began to put your faith on the line?
It did, yes, sir. It was hard. The very first part of the deployment was being immersed in all of this blood and bleeding and dying and danger, and at the same time, as I said, struggling with personal issues, I really felt like I've said that I didn't stop believing in God, but I wondered if he had stopped believing in me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sort of was struggling with being there and wondering why I was there, and asking all those why questions, why me questions. And then the day that really changed was the day that ultimately became the title of the book, was I was caught out in the middle of an open area during a mortar attack, and really had over an hour there alone, being sort of forced to come to grips with God and saying, I give up, I can't be in control, these bombs are going to land on me or they're not, and I need your help.
Mm-hmm.
Really, where I turned the corner in my faith life to from being a person who thought I could manage it and control it on my own, to being aware that the only place I had to hide was in the Lord and His strength, and that really, for me, was the turning point of not only my deployment but of my life before and since then.
I'm talking with Dr. Lee Warren. He's a neurosurgeon who was deployed to Iraq. His book is No Place to Hide. Dr. Warren, let's fast forward, and you come home from the war. When did you begin to realize there were some issues that you hadn't left behind?
Really, I think when I first got home, I was very uncomfortable in public places. I didn't feel comfortable in a crowd. I was sort of irritable and nervous, and I didn't put that all together for a while, but I realized I was somewhat reclusive and wasn't connecting with people like I normally had. My humor was different. I was very serious all the time, and I just wasn't the same person that I had been before I left.
This had an impact on your practicing of medicine and on your family?
It did. My first, when I got out of the Air Force, I first joined a group of other surgeons, and I really had a hard time connecting. I didn't develop the kind of partnership relationship that I would have expected to have done as the person that I used to be. Really, I just didn't feel like I fit in. I didn't feel like I connected. And that ultimately led to me making the decision to go into solo practice, which I think was ultimately a very good decision for me. But at the time, it was really because I felt fairly isolated and like I was having a hard time connecting.
Tell our listeners about how this related to your family. When you began the book, you had left a family that you felt was crumbling, was falling apart. And yet with your experiences, how did that affect how you related when you came back?
Well, as you know from the book, I ultimately went through a divorce. And then I had some time of trying to reconnect with my children. I had a long period of time where I had to learn how to be a parent again because I'd been away from them. And we had to sort of rebuild our relationship from the ground up in the new setting of me not being married relationship with their mother. So that was a very different kind of experience for me and my children, and it took a long time for us to redefine our relationship.
And ultimately, what happened to you family-wise?
Ultimately, I remarried. I married Lisa, and my children and her children integrated, and we felt like we were given a new life. I've told lots of people I feel like Job. I've gained more than I lost, and my family integrated beautifully, and I feel like I had a second chance at a new life.
And about your faith, how did that unpack as you came back and tried to readjust?
Well, as I said, that the day in Iraq when I was mortared and kind of exposed was the day that I finally lost interest in trying to control my own destiny, and in doing so began to really rebuild my faith block by block. And ultimately, when I got home and went through all the family changes that I'd gone through, I finally think I'm allowing the Lord to lead my decisions, lead my sense of direction for my life, and I feel like I landed in a place where I know that the Lord is my protector and my shield, and I know that He is the only place that I can hide, and I feel like He's really redeemed me from being a self-controlling person who was labeled a Christian to being a person who rests in the strength and security of His Savior.
Dr. W. Lee Warren is an author. He's written the book No Place to Hide, A Brain Surgeon's Long Journey Home from the Iraq War. It's published by Zondervan. Dr. Warren, where can people get a copy of this book?
I think everywhere. It's on Amazon. It should be in major bookstores and pretty much in any of the online distributors, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere you can buy a book, I think the No Place to Hide should be there.
Thank you so much. I can recommend this book highly to our listeners. I'm finding it fascinating and interesting and an encouraging book of faith. Dr. Warren, thanks for being with us today on LifeQuest.
Thank you so much for having me, Dwight. I appreciate your time.
I'll be back in just a moment.
Joining us today on LifeQuest, here are your hosts, Dwight Lanoff.
We're talking today with Liesl Geschke. She's a marriage and family therapist. She's a music therapist, a mother, and, coincidentally, my daughter. Liesl, what sort of counseling do you do?
Well, I work mostly with families of children that are 0 to 5. I can also work with teenagers and couples for marriage counseling, but my affinity is towards young children and families working on parenting, behaviors, and special needs.
If this wasn't an official interview, I'd say, well, how did your family do when you were growing up? But I'm not going to ask you that. You have had, for some time, a special interest in autism, and we hear a lot more about that these days than we did in years past. Now, why is that? Do we have more problems with autism or what?
Well, that is the number one question when it comes to autism. They are now saying that autism affects 1 in 68 children and 1 in 42 boys. They don't know why. They have many, many theories of why, but all we can do is work with what we get.
And nobody really seems to know why this seems to be a part of boys rather than girls as far as percentage.
Well, they have found a genetic link that makes them more susceptible to autism, but it doesn't necessarily cause autism.
Okay.
And the cause is what they are not sure of.
In the little bit I've read, there seems to be a variety of symptoms in different children with autism.
That's correct. It is considered a spectrum disorder. And if you think of it as an umbrella or even a bell curve, there is the bottom where they're very severely affected and then the top where they are mildly affected. And that is where you're going to see Asperger's and some of the high intelligence, but some quirky behaviors and social skills problems.
Now, at the more severe types of autism, what kind of symptoms do we see?
Many times these children are nonverbal. They do not show eye contact. They prefer to be in their own world, not having social interaction with people. They prefer objects over toys. Mm-hmm. They will line items up or stack them instead of playing productively with a toy. A lot of times you'll also see repetitive behaviors such as rocking back and forth, spinning, hand flapping, looking at spinning objects, looking at lights, those kinds of things.
What triggered your interest in this particular phenomenon?
Well, I believe that started when I was doing music therapy. And in my internship in Los Angeles, part of that experience was working one-on-one with children with autism using music. Mm-hmm. It was fun to do, but very, very difficult. Very difficult to get an interaction with the child. But that is where it began. And then the course of my growing up in my 20s, every time I'd move away from special needs, I'd end up coming back somehow. Mm-hmm. Ended up working in California's regional center where they provide case management and services for children, well, all people with developmental disabilities, and I worked for them for 8 years, and that is probably where I got my strongest desire to work with those families.
What is the spectrum of treatment for these children?
There are a variety of treatments, and that also depends on where in the country you live. On the West Coast, and I believe this is due to UCLA, they really focus on behavior modification. Lovas is who started the behavior modification and came out of UCLA. And they really focus on doing discrete trials and behavior modification. I hate to say this, but a little bit like dog training, where you ask the child to do something. If they do it, you give them a reward. On the East Coast, another part of the country, there is another form of treatment called floor time, and that is more of a relational approach, and that is where you meet the child where they are and work relationally with them to pull them out of the developmental level they're at. For instance, if a child is pacing the room back and forth, instead of asking them to stop and do something else, you join that child in the activity that they're doing and create a game out of it. So you'll possibly turn it into a game of chase or a tickle game or a peekaboo game. So you woo the child into an interaction with you. There are other treatments that are more physical, such as the food, different food items, different detoxifications, things that are less research.
Does this change as the child grows up? Do we find adults with autism? How does this work?
Yes. If we can catch a child between 0 and 3 and give them intense treatments, which would be a mix of the behavioral, the relational, speech therapy, occupational therapy, all these things, and work very intensely with them throughout the school years, they can learn skills and learn to adapt and become more functional. The longer that it takes for a person to become diagnosed and get treatment, the more severe the behaviors are going to be, and they will have a more difficult time blending into society and becoming functional. So they've done a lot of research, and they definitely have proven that the earlier you can start working with these children, the better they are. You will find most of the children in these numbers of 1 in 68 that are elementary age, less that are older, although some of it are undiagnosed, and they would probably be your higher functioning.
This must be very difficult for parents who come to the conclusion or have their child diagnosed as such. What kind of support can be provided?
This is definitely true. A lot of what happens at the beginning is the parent will get the idea that something is wrong with their child because they're not speaking and not interacting and playing appropriately. Unfortunately, a lot of times when they bring this up to the pediatrician, they just tell them, well, just wait, they'll probably start talking when they're 4. So part of what therapists and the researchers have started doing is educating pediatricians and family practice doctors on autism and how to catch that quickly. Once the family does get in the diagnosis and into services, it can become very intense because these children are in therapy most of the day, most of the week. They can get anywhere from 10 to 40 hours of therapy a week, and it can be very distressing. And along with the therapies, just part of being a child with autism is the inability to cope with sensory stimulation, and they often will have major tantrums and meltdowns, which is very difficult on the parents. So some of the things that I've actually done with families, besides one-on-one counseling and working relationally with them and their child to teach them to bond with their child, is to provide parent support groups. And that is where you get parents together who are all in the same boat, where they can share stories, they can share coping skills, they can share different things that they've tried, and that seems to be very helpful to the family.
There's got to be books out there regarding autism and maybe even helpful books for parents or grandparents, extended family. Can you give me suggestions to our listening audience about them?
Absolutely. I will give you a couple of things. One thing to be careful of is if you type in autism into a search engine on the computer, you're going to find a million and one things on there, and some of it is good and some of it is not. So a couple of the good websites to look at are Autism Speaks, which is a society who has done a lot of research and a lot of support. The other is Autism Society, and they're regional. So there's Autism Society of California and Autism Society of Oregon, and, you know, so those are separate. But you can find those on the Internet. Some of my favorite books that I like, because I tend to come from the relational spectrum because I'm a marriage and family therapist, mm-hmm. are the Floor Time books. And Dr. Stanley Greenspan is the person who worked very strongly, who developed this program, and he was from the East Coast. And two of my favorite books from him are Engaging Autism and The Child with Special Needs. What I enjoy about these books is that they spend a lot of time describing the behaviors and then how to connect with the child and make it an enjoyable experience, because so many times the parent has such a hard time connecting with their child and can feel very, very frustrated. And that, so his focus was on making the relationship enjoyable. Another one, most children with autism have issues with sensory processing, how they take in sensations in the world. So another very good book is Sensational Kids by Lucy Jane Miller, who's an occupational therapist, and The Out of Sync Child by Carol Kranowitz. And these focus more on the sensory aspect, on how these children are taking in sensations, why they do that, and some activities that you can do to help the children cope with the sensory overloads that they get. And one last book that I like, but would be more controversial, I suppose, is called Healing the New Childhood Epidemics of Autism, ADHD, Asthma, and Allergies. And this focuses more on a holistic approach and how certain foods and possibly GMOs have affected, environmental issues have affected these children.
Liesl Geschke is a marriage and family therapist, a music therapist with special interest in autism. Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net. I'm Dwight Lainhoff.